The name of the song is Ball and Chain, and we let our guest this afternoon, who's written a wonderful book that we're going to go deep into, is called Why Willie Mae Thornton Matters. The song you heard was Ball and Chain by Big Mama Thornton, but the book is titled Willie Mae Thornton. So we're going to even talk about the whole concept of what Big Mama means and doesn't mean. But our guest this afternoon is not only an author, but a DJ who has serious chops, a scholar. You have a pretty big bio here. DJ Lene, Denise is our guest. So I'll give you your flowers. A global practitioner of sound language in Black Atlantic thought, is an Amsterdam-based writer and interdisciplinary artist from Los Angeles, California. Shaped by her parents' record collections in the 1980s, Denise's work traces the foregrounds, the intimacies of underground nightclub movements, music migrations, and bass culture in the African diaspora. She coined the term DJ scholarship in 2013, which explores how knowledge is gathered, interpreted, and produced through a conceptual and theoretical framework, shifting the role of the DJ from a party purveyor to an archivist and cultural worker. She's a doctoral student in the Department of Visual Culture at Goldsmiths University of London. And that's just the beginning. And she's been at the helm of many groundbreaking artistic and academic productions, including After the Last Dance, the first and only Michael Jackson conference with the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, the School of Prince with Los Angeles Public Library, and Aretha Franklin's Amazing Grace from Detroit to watch the first conference dedicated to solely chronicling the musical life of the Queen of Soul with the UCLA African American Studies Department, and now the author of the book Why Willie Mae, Big Mama Thornton Matters. Welcome to the show, Lynette, DJ Lynette. How you doing?
Thank you. Thank you so much, David D. I'm honored to be on this show. You are a living legend and critical thought, hip hop purveyor, scholar, community-based, deep listener, deep crate digging through the
Wow.
political history of hip hop and the Bay and Black life in general. So I'm honored to be in conversation with you.
I appreciate the props. What's your Venmo
Oh, come on
now?
now. Yes.
You know,
Listen,
the
I made it
pay the lady,
easy.
pay the lady, you know. That's
We agreed on a certain amount.
you know,
No.
that's my
Yeah.
publicist out there, you know. No. No, we were talking just before we got on air, and I was asking you, respecting you as a DJ, if you could pick a song by Big Mama Thornton. We were going back and forth, and you said, you know, look at the Saved album. I have to admit, I knew Hound Dog and a couple other cuts, but I had not really dug deep into the catalog until I was reading this book. And I was like, oh, snap, I've been missing out. So, you know, I got to go and get all her stuff and add it to the repertoire because she's a beast, you know,
She's a
and
beast.
she's a beast. And we picked Ball and Chain, but you were telling me a story about how she kind of introduces that song. And I thought maybe we could start off and you could, off the cuff, share with us, you know, how she usually does this song. You know, in concerts when she was around, because I think that kind of underscores the woman that we're talking about this afternoon.
That's a perfect place to start. Yeah. We chose Ball and Chain, for a number of reasons. First, it's a song that was written in the Bay. So let's even give it this kind of, Black musical geographies history and the context, right? Like, because it is through this song, Ball and Chain, that she wrote in 1961, that I came into contact with this archive of like Black-owned blues labels in the Bay, right? So she recorded this song in 1961. And Janis Joplin heard her perform the song and proceeded to go backstage that night in San Francisco where she heard her perform Ball and Chain, and she asked permission along with her band to cover the song. And Willie Mae on the spot wrote on a napkin the lyrics to that song, and Janis Joplin in turn began to perform it. And with the Big Brother Holding Company, they performed it, I believe, at the Monterey Pop Festival. But of course, Janis Joplin blew up with the song.
Oh,
It is a
wow.
song that, yes, it is a song. It is a song that Janis Joplin has become famous for. And so we'll get into some of the Elvis Presley history, obviously, with Hound Dog a little bit. But what was interesting about Ball and Chain, and just say the very basic and baseline difference between Janis Joplin and Elvis Presley, was that Janis Joplin constantly credited Willie Mae for writing the song and created a situation where she would get royalties for the song. And
Okay.
so there was a different balance, there was a different level of respect, different from Elvis and his camp, is what I'm saying. But still, because Willie Mae had dealt with the extreme blow to her career, right, of having Elvis sing the song Hound Dog, which she originally performs in 1952. I think Elvis Presley recorded it again in, I think, 1956, and he blows up. This is one of the songs that keeps him rich until this day,
Right.
right? And so, because she was burned and she understood that the music industry, it's not about just like white cultural appropriation. It's actually about the political economy of Black music and the long, long history of Black artists being exploited, right? So this woman was a victim of the music industry's exploitive practices. And I want to be honest and say some of those folks who exploited her were the Black men who owned some of those labels, like Don
Yeah.
Roby.
Right. We got
People
to
have
talk about
stories.
him. Yeah.
Of course, people have stories about Berry Gordy. People have stories about probably like Master P, whoever are running these labels and using these similar tactics, right? Because they've proven themselves to be, successful tactics, getting publishing rights, right? And so because she was burned, every time she would introduce Ball and Chain, she would give you a little hint of shade to let you know that she was the original. Right. She did not place herself in a category of peers with Janis Joplin. So she would say something like, "Ladies and gentlemen, I wrote this song in 1961, and it was recorded by a young lady by the name of Janis Joplin. But I made this song and I made it famous. I wrote this song and I sing it the way I want it. Now, Janis may have sung it in the way she wanted, but I don't know nothing about that. What I know is that this is my song and this is how I perform it." And then, like right on the one, the band would come in with
Right.
the deep bass, And so it was just a powerful anthem that gave her story more legs than the simple Elvis Presley stole her song moment.
Right. I think it's important to have that backdrop. And I say this because there's a generation disconnect and one that erases important history. And I think I was just talking about this. I might have did it on the show, but it was somewhere else. I was talking about, well, we just did a thing on Ella Fitzgerald, right? And, in her book, she's like, "You call me Ella Fitzgerald, Miss Fitzgerald." She insists on that. And there's a video going around that shows Maya Angelou, Dr. Maya Angelou, chastising a young woman who just called her Maya. And there's a whole new generation of people is like, "Man, she's stuck up. Who does she think she is?" And they're going off, right? Not really understanding. It's like, all these titles and woo, right? But when I'm reading, the thing about Ella, there's a whole backdrop about how Black women were, in a pejorative way, called by their first name. So we don't call you Dr. DJ Lynae Thompson. I just go, "Lynae, what's going on?" And it's not done out of familiarity, But it's done out of a way like I ain't gonna call you no doctor. Like I ain't gonna call you Cassius. I ain't gonna call you Muhammad. Your mama called you Cassius. So it's a way of putting you in your place. And so
Absolutely.
there was an insistence, for many generations, including my mom and others. Like you call me by, Miss Mom, but you don't call me by my first name. And the brothers, on the other hand, were like, don't call me boy, you call me man. So there were these things about reclaiming language. And so what I thought was interesting, one, is to hear the backstory about how she's claiming her space, because if you don't, you completely get erased. And somebody might be listening who doesn't know the backstory and be like, man, what is she, egotistical? What's going on? Not realizing. Like, you seriously got burnt. Even, and there's, I don't know, there's, I hate to use the word trauma, but you just don't get over that. You don't get over
No.
that when you have your stuff, taken and people are flossing and bossing and attributing you, somebody else to your work. It's kind of like,
Absolutely.
so this kind of comes into, one of the questions about Big Mama. You kind of put it in parentheses, but you talk about in the book. There's a whole chapter about the term Big Mama and what that means, and why it wasn't always cool just to call her that.
Yeah, and I want to make it clear, because many of us Black folks have grandmothers that we refer to as Big Mama. Like, and
Right.
we knew exactly what we meant, and we knew that that was a very serious term of respect and endearment, right?
Yes.
Like Big Mama, implies mother of the whole family. Big Mama is the safe space for, me and all my cousins, my mother and her siblings, right? When
Yeah.
you go to Big Mama's house, you are safe. But then there's another Big Mama that comes to mind when we place that word in the sort of collective imagination of white folks.
Yeah.
Perhaps they are thinking of the quote unquote Big Mamas who raise their children. Maybe
Yeah.
they are thinking about the Big Mamas who clean their homes. It is not necessarily spoken with the same kind of respect
It's a
that we
euphemism. It's a euphemism for mammy.
it's up there with Mammy.
Yeah.
It's up there with Mammy.
There was a story that goes around here about the woman that is the district attorney, right? Pamela Price, and they're trying to recall her, saying that the reason crime is happening is because of her. But, there's a lot of white folks and non-black folks who started calling her Aunt Pam, right? And, and folks are like, yo, you don't do that, because somebody put a story out, say and it's a false story saying the criminals call her Auntie Pam. And there's like all these threads with folks. I don't understand why I can't say that. Like, yeah, you're, if we had you on TV, people would be like, oh, she's shocked too.
No, I mean, yeah. Not in the context of the Bay, but yeah. I said, yeah, go ahead.
But it does come back to, because you point this out in the book as well, there are these communal languages, communication, spoken words, things that have deeper meaning. And we need to know that. And, and I think you kind of lay that out, as to what Big Mama meant, why it was important, and why, you didn't start off with your title, Big Mama. It's in parentheses, so we know who you're talking about. But, and then, why did she have to take that name? Because that seems also more like that was put on her, not because of a term of endearment, but just because she was a big woman,
And it's complicated, right? Because she also uses the term to refer to herself. And so I'm not shaming her or judging her. I'm asking my readers to consider this long-standing history of Black women being mammified, right? And so, or even being limited to their size. Even if she was called Big Mama because of her size, there is a potential, there's the potential threat of harm and ill will in that, because I don't care about her size the way that I care about her voice, the way that I care about how she writes lyrics, the way I care about how she plays the drums, the way I care about how she plays the harmonica. And so what happens when you place Big Mama out there as the primary title is, again, when it's coming through the hands of music journalists that are describing who she is, oftentimes those descriptive words are limited to things that point to her size and not her musicianship. Right?
And
So,
I didn't realize she was that deep of a musician.
deep musician, a drummer, a harmonic, like, listen, and just an incredible talent.
Right. And I think when you have the term Big Mama without that understanding, you just think, well, all these big women, they go to church and they sing,
That's
and
it.
you don't see the brilliance. Like, she produces, she writes her lyrics, she does all these different things. I want to get into some of the deeper things, but I want to kind of familiarize our audience. And, if you could briefly give us a Willie Mae Thornton 101, some highlights that either you point out in the book or highlights that we should absolutely know when we talk about her.
Yeah, it's important to know that this is a Black woman who was the child of the South. She was from Alabama. And this is a person whose mother died at an early age, which meant she had to be pulled out of school to care for her mother before she passed. And when her mother passed, her father, the then widow, wasn't able to care for all of the kids. And so Willie Mae had to take on odd jobs, domestic work in the 30s, early 40s, until she comes across a woman by the name of Diamond Teeth Mary, who recognizes her, interestingly enough, because of her size, but also because of her voice. And Willie Mae had gotten a job on a garbage truck, throwing away garbage as a part of her living as a young woman, barely a
Was she a young
teen.
woman? I was going to say she was a teenager when this is happening.
Yeah, she was a teenager. And so Diamond Teeth Mary, who was also a blues woman, was in town as a part of Sammy Green's Hot House Review, which was a review on the vaudeville circuit, let Willie Mae know that there was an audition for Sammy Green's review. And Willie Mae auditioned and she made it. And that was her ticket out of Alabama or through Alabama, right? Because oftentimes with these vaudeville folks and reviews in the 1940s, they would tour the Black South, right? But they'd go to, Georgia and not just Atlanta, but also Savannah, and not just Savannah, but also Augusta, right? So she traveled throughout the South, in these major cities and the smaller but major cities, and became acquainted with folks like Little Richard, who was also on the vaudeville circuit, and also Bessie Smith, who was reaching an older age, but always an influence to Willie Mae. And from there, Willie Mae hopped ship after being there for several years because of money issues, and she went to Texas, and she eventually signed with Don Robey,
That
and
was
it's just
Peacock Records.
Peacock Records owned by Don Robey, right? Don Robey was the president, the owner of Peacock Records. But yes, thank you, Peacock Records. And Willie Mae becomes part of the kind of formation, I would argue, of rhythm and blues in Texas. During that time, she performed a lot of songs that were actually written by Don Robey, often songs referencing her weight, her size, her height, but she was most known for her super lively performances. So she stays at Peacock Records for years. She's moving between, all over Texas and performing until eventually, still while signed to Don Robey's label, to Peacock Records, she is hooked up with Johnny Otis, who
Out
is
of the bay.
essentially out of the
Out of the
Bay,
bay. Got that
out
bay
of
flavor.
Berkeley,
Yeah.
Berkeley,
Right.
Berkeley. As a matter of fact, I'm going to speed this up and just talk about how Because I'll just, so these are key points where she hooks up with Johnny Otis, who is also the father of Sugie Otis, Strawberry
Yeah.
Letter 22. For those of you who may not know, he's from Berkeley. He's Greek, but he was like black passing and had his own review. And Willie Mae was part of that review as a part of Peacock Records, who he was also working with. Long story short, Don Robey essentially commissions him as a producer to work with Willie Mae. And Johnny Otis introduces Willie Mae to Stoller and Lieber, who are the original authors of Hound Dog. And they recorded that song in Johnny Otis's garage in 1951, 52. And once it's recorded, I just want to let you know that even before it was recorded, Don Robey had publishing rights to Hound Dog. And Don Robey did not, right? And of course, Willie Mae did not. So, they write and record Hound Dog, and Don Robey puts it on the shelf. He releases it like 2 years later. It becomes a massive hit on Black radio in Black spaces.
Right.
And then 2 years later, it becomes, popularized by Elvis and his camp. And really, it's the song that set off, some would argue, his career. But I think what I want to tell your listeners is what is important is that that is not where her story begins or ends, that she was performing for at least 15 years, for somewhere between 10 and 15 years before recording that song. And
Right.
then she continues to perform like another 20 years after. So she has a 40-year body of work that needs our time and energy and attention. And she moved from Alabama to Texas, from Texas to Cali. She toured Europe as a part of the American, Folk
Right.
Blues Festival,
And has an
and
influence
eventually,
there.
and has a massive
Bit
influence there.
influence, yeah. So let's go back. And this, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with author DJ. I'm gonna put that DJ there because that's what you get busy with, Lanae
Thank you.
Denise. But she's also a scholar. I shouldn't say but she's also a scholar and has her chops in all these things. But I think it's important as a DJ because you even make note that you're approaching the writing of this book with that in mind. And so the way that you're weaving the information in and out, it's almost like, like if you're doing a set at a party. And so I think people will enjoy reading that in that manner. With that being said, you spend a lot of time, or you spend at least a good chapter talking about the Alabama roots. And I want to go back to that because I have a lot of conversations with folks and two cities come up as jump off. Atlanta is an obvious one. So that's like now the Black Mecca. But if you talk to somebody like David Banner, he will give you a whole history list of everybody who has a relative or an uncle or aunt from Mississippi and claimed them. And I have a conversation saying, you do know Nate Dogg's people were from Mississippi. Like, okay, Snoop's people from Mississippi. And he goes on and on. And you too. Right, Mississippi roots. And of course, we look at Mississippi, then we start talking about the Delta Blues, and we start talking about all this talent that people argue was in the soil and in the air. But you kind of give the treatment of Alabama, and I didn't realize Alabama had a lot of flavor. You said it's a funky city. So let's share a little bit about Alabama's roots, where Willie Mae comes out of. And there are some folks that can go head to head with Mississippi.
Oh, for sure. I
Yeah.
mean, yeah, breaking down that chapter was fun. I mean, and thinking about the fact that John Coltrane is from Alabama, Sun Ra is from
Yeah,
Alabama, Michael Jackson's people, as in Katherine Jackson is from Alabama, Stevie Wonder's mother is from Alabama, Angela Davis is from Alabama,
right.
right? Willie Mae Thornton is from Alabama. So, I mean, yes. What I talked about was the fact that we have to reckon with the funk in the soil of Alabama. Because
Right.
if Alabama is out here giving birth to Sun Ra and Angela Davis, and perhaps if Alabama is the place that ignited so much hatred for Black people that these four little girls were bombed in an Alabama church. If Alabama is so, white Alabamans in particular are so concerned about revenge that they create these like black codes that would make it illegal for black folks to play their drums, to sing in public, to gather in more than two or three, groups of or people of three, right? So
And this
it's
is during
letting,
slavery and
this is during
post-slavery.
slavery and post-slavery. And quite
Post-slavery.
honestly, it could be argued that it happens now, right?
Yeah.
What happens when cops see three or more black people, in certain areas and how they become policed for being more than two people sharing a space at the same time. So I had to deal with Alabama's violent history, its plantation history, its history of lynching. But I really want to pay attention to why white folks have been historically afraid to the point of violence of black music.
Yeah.
And Alabama is one of those places where those laws began, right? Where black music was policed and monitored and deemed, illegal and criminal.
Let
That's
me
one
ask.
aspect of it.
Yeah.
But let me just wrap this up and say the other aspect of it is that black folks ourselves, our complicated relationship with the South, particularly those of us whose people come from Mississippi and Alabama, and then though, people move and migrate to the bigger cities, bigger states, California, my people, Chicago, New York. But what happens is the further we are from those southern roots, the more kind of pretentious we become, right? And we kind of associate the Black South with being a place that's backwards, which is what I write about,
Yeah.
and how we used to refer to weed as, if you had good weed, it was Indo, and if you had, poor quality weed, it was called Bama, right? That
Yeah.
we were that we would critique the southern accents. And then I was like, hold on. Snoop has a southern accent. Gangster
Right.
rappers have southern accents. Like, why is that? And then you begin to do that music mapping and that tracing, and you remember something that Mary Baraka said, which is that, the Black South is like the Black American country. It's the motherland
Right.
for Black Americans.
And also, what is also pointed out, you point out, is that each state has its own sound and its own vibe. So New Orleans is its own country. I mean Louisiana, but within that, New Orleans and Baton Rouge and all those places. But you step in there, it's like going to a whole country. And you go into Mississippi, and I think many of us are now familiar because there's been so much advocacy around that. It's its own thing.
Totally.
Same thing with Georgia. It is so much that we now know it. Texas, of course, has its own. We know that that has a lot of history. When you look at that. But then Alabama was one of those places that you just, as you said, it was almost a pejorative. You're Bama in D.C., you're Bama weed, all that. But you, as you was pointing out, the richness of it. One of the things that stood out, and I didn't realize, and you've mentioned it earlier, is that Willie Mae Thornton played instruments, played drums, but I didn't know she was friends with Stevie, and he was the one that got her the harmonica and got into that. Was that?
No,
Oh, no. Okay, maybe I'm.
no, I understand how you saw. Yeah, no, what I was saying in that is that I came into and I was introduced to the harmonica through Stevie Wonder, right?
Okay.
And because I am born in 1975 in Los Angeles, California, where like I didn't grow up on the blues at all, even though my grandmother was listening to Coco Taylor and Johnny B. Just different folks I
Yeah.
just associated with old music, older people's music. I was listening to hip hop and soul and funk. I didn't have no time for blues, right? But what I was saying was that, I think about Stevie Wonder on Do I Do, right? And just Stevie Wonder in the 80s having the harmonica. That's my context. My context is not the blues, but it's in fact harmonica. But Willie Mae's brother gave her
Okay, I
the
misread.
harmonica.
Okay.
That's okay. Yeah, but it's a lot in these chapters. A lot.
Right.
There's a lot of layers. So I understand that how you misread that.
But still, she had that, and you point out that she's not allowed to play it on her records for so long. What was that
Yeah.
about?
I mean, it's probably connected to the very same reasons why we consider people like Roberta Flack, Aretha Franklin, and Nina Simone and Sarah Vaughan to be singers when they're actually accomplished pianists, some of them multi-instrumentalists, right? We are much more comfortable with women being accessories to music through the voice. That women's role in music is to be singers, right? To not write. So even when we talk about Alice Coltrane, right? We talk about her as John's wife. We don't talk about Alice Coltrane as a multi-instrumentalist who plays the harp, who plays piano, who plays synthesizers, right? Like she was also an electronic musician. So yeah, Bobby Humphrey on the flute, we're talking about Rosetta Thorpe on the guitar.
Would Abby Lincoln fall into that as well?
Ooh, you know why I really appreciate you is because I've been listening to Abby Lincoln and Max Roach for the past 3 days. I am not familiar with Abby's work enough to know that she played physical instruments in addition to her voice, which she absolutely played as a as an instrument. Did she play any other instruments?
That I don't know. That's what I'm
But
asking.
that's a powerful question though, just because her voice does more than sing,
Like Ella
and so
Fitzgerald,
totally.
Gets, yeah.
Betty
Yeah,
Carter, who's
Betty Carter,
scatting
yeah.
and get. Yeah, so, oh yeah, and let me be clear that even if you are just a quote unquote just a singer, you are an instrumentalist, you are a musician, right? And so even if Aretha and Roberta and these women didn't play piano and harp and these other things, they'd still be musicians. But my point is that Black women are not read as and represented as, masterful musicians. And so, yeah, Willie Mae was discouraged from playing the flute until she signed, or till she recorded that first album in London, right? And another Bay Area, Chris, can't remember his name. Yes, but yes. So
How much of limiting the role of women, Black women in this case, to just being quote unquote singers had to do with respectability politics and marketing and defined gender roles? And those are things that you talk about a lot in the book as well.
No, good question. Yeah, a lot of it was about marketing because it says something about a patriarchal culture that prefers that women be in supporting roles, and that is extended to music, that women are there to support male producers and musicians, right? And so I guess that's why we
But
need and
that's
love people like Lauryn Hill.
right. But that's such a okay. So the way I've seen it, and I think you said it, and others have pointed out, maybe with Angela Davis as well. It was these women that record like the first blues. Your Ma Rainey's, your Bessie Smith, right? Who's the other? There's a few others. I'll think of them. But these are bigger than life figures. They kind of define and kick in the doors. And I, in my mind, I see Willie Mae Thornton as an extension of that, of kicking in doors and being, those, that powerful presence, in that regard. And so one would think that if you understand that, then let's expand upon it. And there is no room to expand. You're seeing the stories behind the scenes, like you said, the Don Robbie's are like, now you're not playing on this thing. You're not going to play on these on this album. So it just, I don't know. It seems like that there's an erasing from the jump. There's a limitation from the jump, and I don't know if it's ever really been reconciled until people like yourself are writing these books and you're going, I didn't know, because I didn't know, all
Yeah,
this
we
stuff.
don't know. Yeah. No, we have to dig, right? And so part of it is You hope that you have the willingness to take women's lives serious enough to be curious about those lives. How about how curiosity is one way that we can protect the honor of these women, right? And that's the curiosity that Angela Davis had when she wrote the book Blues Legacies and Black Feminism, right? Which, you know, and I know that you were just referencing that, was a major sort of guide in me writing this book. 'Cause I'm like, yo, I'm a B girl from LA, born in 1975, grew up on, you know, everybody from, you know, Rick Rubin. That's interesting that I named him first, but I was just thinking of Def Jam and the fact that Beastie Boys was my first album, knew every Public Enemy album verbatim, grew up, I'm talking about Gangstar, Poor Righteous Teachers, Main Source. These are my, I had no relationship to the blues, even though we know folks like Premier and different folks were like sampling the blues. It was very distant. So I think like I had to have curiosity, but I needed a guide. Like, who is someone who kind of like has nothing to do with the blues, who seemingly has nothing to do with the blues or even music, and then they write this book? And it was Angela Davis, because when she came out about when she came out with a book about music, people were confused. But why? You know, like actually part of her revolutionary acts are about loving Black people, certainly beyond their trauma, right? And so she taught me and she modeled what it meant to care for these Black women and to help me come up with a line of questions in that care. And also to help me learn how to listen to those Black women closely beyond their songs, but to kind of listen between the lot between the lines of their lives to figure out who they were.
I mentioned that she comes out of a line of women, and there's a queerness, gender non-conforming within that, the Ma Rainey's, Bessie's, and all that. You also, bring into the conversation Little Richard and others. Let's talk a little bit about that. Obviously, the people that I just named are major contributors, to, various genres of music, and they're all around the same time. But you're also, 1930s, 1940s are living in a world that is very intolerant, even though these folks and even Little Richard talks about, I want to say Billy Wright, I guess was the name, or Bobby
Yeah,
Wright,
exactly.
and others, who are very flamboyant and out there, right? Today we see the flamboyancy of some artists and we kind of take it for granted or even have it expected. So, it's like, well, you got to put on these crazy outfits and go out there. But when they did it, how much of it was just seen as them being performance versus just expression that is groundbreaking that, brought a lot of things into question, like, why are you wearing a pompadour? Why do you want to wear overalls? In fact, with Willie Mae Thornton, I didn't realize that she was always dressing in overalls and pants. Because the picture that I always associate her with is with her wearing a dress which she didn't like wearing, most of the time.
Precisely, precisely. Yeah, I mean that thin line in Black life between performance and expression, right? It's a thin line. I mean, I have no idea. I can't even imagine who Little Richard was outside of his makeup and full-fledged, you know, I was gonna call it a costume, but I don't know, but right, but that he complicates the word costume. But that's just because it's so authentic in the presentation slash performance that it truly blurs the line. You forget that these are people who are, we know them on stage. We know them on stage. And I guess the recent documentary about Little Richard and learning about his struggles and, you know, and all these folks who struggle with addiction, and like you realize that the Black public performance face versus the Black private face and the thin line between the two, when you consider, say, for example, someone like Whitney Houston's public, you know, sort of downfall. And to go from this like spectacular career to a like hyper sensationalized fall is the it is the like sadly the trajectory for so many Black artists, right? To the point where like I don't know what is performance. I don't know what it, you know, on the one hand, Whitney Houston was like prevented from publicly acknowledging her bisexuality, right? Or and on the other hand, someone like Luther Vandross isn't flamboyant at all. But you know, he was sort of brought out. He was sort of, you know, his sexuality was declared after he passed. It wasn't
Right.
something he was wearing. But anyway, I feel like that's a long-winded answer. But what I'm talking about is just that, like, ultimately, one thing I've been really thinking about is like the fact that Willie Mae Thornton, for example, yes, wore overalls, wore cowboy hats, wore cowboy boots, hated wearing dresses, would sometimes refuse to wear the dress, would have the record company buy the dress, and she would show up on stage with the overalls instead. Like that, we really, you know, have to fight for privacy. And Willie Mae never, ever, ever admitted and shared that she was lesbian or gay or queer.
Right. As you were talking, DJ Lene Denise, who's our guest, author of the book, Why Willie Mae, Big Mama Thornton Matters. You know, for Black folks, for us as Black folks, one of the ways in which we were able to find a sense of our humanity and be authentic was through these expressions. Through song and dance, right? Where we were allowed to do it. Maybe couldn't play the drums, but we would sing the hell out of a song, right? And then when you look at the functionality of music, you understand that music serves a variety of purposes, you know, in the African diaspora, more than just the commodity. I think oftentimes we look at it as the commodity and realize, well, if she's singing, I'm singing too. You know, she's singing, I'm dancing. If you DJ and I'm getting, you know, we all, it's a participatory thing, and we find ourselves and lose ourselves within those expressions. And that's how maybe we collectively have had to respond to oppression, you know, based upon race. You know, I can't really be myself, but I'm gonna sing this song and you're gonna feel it. You might even fear it, you know, because of the way I'm bringing it across, right?
Absolutely.
But if you scale it down, maybe Little Richard, if he's struggling with, you know, who he is sexually speaking, he's going to lose himself in the pompadour and, you know, in the crazy lyrics. And I'm wondering if we're seeing some of that with some of those artists, you know, like I'll go extra hard, but I'm doing this because this is the only space that I can be myself. Would that apply there? You see it?
I appreciate that reading of it. You know, like literally a kind of getting in where you fit in. Like
Right.
it's literally that expression embodied. Yes, I fully agree that like folks had to find pieces of themselves in a world that demanded their hyper visibility, being
And that visibility
overseen.
had to be confined to boxes. Otherwise,
Yes,
you was in danger.
exactly. Yes, exactly. And also in the face of a kind of invisibility, because all you get reduced to is that of a performer, that of a person who entertains, or even a thing that entertains, right? Like, or, you know, so this is coming from the fact that I often think about, you know, again, the plantation model that the music industry replicates, and this idea of Black labor and white wealth. The hyper performance, the hyper visibility creates a kind of invisibility.
One of the things I appreciate that you did in the book, I mean, obviously it's focusing on Willie Mae Thornton, but you also parallel a lot of other things and you give us a good view of what's going on. I was always curious about Don Robey, right? The owner of Peacock Records. We often hear of Barry Gordy, right? To a lesser degree, well, Chess Records wouldn't count in that, but you know, this was a powerful figure, you know, who owned a lot of stuff and When I first heard about Peacock Records, I was like, oh wow, this is like maybe even something. Well, it predates Motown, right? It exists before Motown, and it's just a guy that owns taxi cab companies and he's running things. And then you hear the craziness, like, oh snap, this dude is like a Suge Knight figure before Suge Knight, and maybe even worse. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because here, Willie Mae Thornton is signed to a label where the owner, beat the hell out of Little Richard, was known for that, like he was the guy that might have been the prototype of dangling people over, balconies
Exactly,
and doing all these
exactly.
things. And what's crazy is that this is happening in the Jim Crow South, and this is a successful businessman who I think you pointed out mimicked the rough and tumbleness of the music industry, where some of the things I just described also went on the white side of town, and oftentimes, sadly, with black artists. So let's talk a little bit about Don Robey and the relationship that Willie Mae Thornton had with him, on because he didn't really step to her; he stepped to everybody else, but he left her, let her be.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to know that she also had part-time jobs as a security guard.
She
You
did.
know, like, yep. But I talk about it in the book, or like she would be, a little bit in the book, and just like maybe a sentence where I just talk about like what she did, for extra money, shiny shoes, security, but also that she was known to physically attack promoters who attempted to cheat her. Right, that she was arrested multiple times. Yes, because of her height. She talked about carrying, a weapon of protection. This was not a woman to be played with, and who comes to mind for me is someone like Della Reese's character in Harlem Nights, even though Big Mama Thornton slash Willie Mae was, or rather Willie Mae slash Big Mama wasn't feminine like Della Reese. There's a way that Della Reese was treated by the male characters, by the Eddie Murphys, by the Red Foxes, that let you know that she was a peer and also not someone to play with. You don't come for, you don't come for her. So Willie Mae, had that stature. Yeah, her size mattered in the context of not being as intimidated by folks like Don Robey. Don Robey was a white passing, successful businessman who owned multiple sort of like, enterprises before eventually investing in a club. And once he invested in the club, he would, he made a name for that club, which is like a middle black middle class Texan, performance space, and decided to enter the music industry. But I think what's really important about Don Robey, absolutely, he was a bully. Absolutely, he exploited the artists. Marie Adams was one of those artists, Clarence Gatemouth Brown, like a number of artists, but I think what's really interesting is that he worked with a woman as his partner, not his romantic one, but his business partner, and her name was Evelyn Johnson, also from Texas, right? And so Evelyn Johnson and Don Robey played a role in creating the infrastructure that made the Chitlin Circuit possible, right? And by infrastructure, I mean creating a kind of legal network that made it possible for the artists that were on their labels to move through the South, right?
And
And be able to perform.
that's what I found brilliant, about that. And thanks for
Yeah.
bringing up Evelyn. I had her name in the top of the thing,
Yes.
because you talk about she went out and got licenses, and it allowed her to do some things that were kind of groundbreaking at that time, right? So she could book
Yeah.
shows and things like that. I think some of the things that are mentioned we kind of take for granted and don't realize, like you just couldn't get up there and just do any old thing. Even when some people kind of, romanticize about, well, if we just stop integrating and do for self, yeah, but you still had to go and engage folks in order to have a nightclub.
Absolutely.
You had to engage the power structure to actually book these acts. You had to
Yes.
have these cabaret things
Yes.
and all that. it in order to just exist, and so I think we kind of forget about that, and they were doing that as you described, and I thought that was a side note, in the book, but an important one to give it fuller context,
No, thank you for reading that closely. That's exactly what I meant. And yeah, what do we mean when we say black music? Just like the question of what do we mean when we say black film, and is it black if your only options to distribute it is through major white companies and labels? Or who is responsible for marketing and framing, the nature of that music? Who gets paid to make it possible for the artist to tour and all of those things? And so the fact that Don Robey and Evelyn, I was gonna say Evelyn Champagne King, that's ridiculous. And Evelyn Johnson and Don Robey had this brilliant master plan, to kind of keep it as black as possible. I think what's also interesting is the number of white folks that would try to attend these black spaces, right? But yeah, they created a situation where, I'm sorry, where like they were essentially independent.
Right, but at the same time, is it black if you're exploiting black in the same manner as white?
Yeah, no,
And
that's
that
the
becomes the complicated thing too. It's like I
complicated.
love the story of Don Robey. At the same time, I'm like, damn, like really, son? Like why were you this type of person? And then sometimes we can justify it if we're in the music industry. Well, the rough and tumble business, and that's just how they do it. And they did it on that side of town, and we did it on this side of town. But is it liberation when you're just replicating systems
No,
of oppression?
absolutely not. It is absolutely not liberation. And it's, aspirational by every sense of the word. I use the word aspirational because I'm thinking about Berry Gordy and the number of women in particular who had a very, very hard time with the fact that Motown kept so much of the publishing, also the production with the in-house, Funk Brothers and all of this, Berry Gordy, I think, escapes a kind of critical scrutiny around how he used those same exploitive practices, perhaps because of the respectability, right? The squeaky clean nature that Motown has versus like a Don Robey who's working with the gritty blues men like Clarence Gatemount Brown and even like the like. Willie Mae was like gangster, and she was grimy in terms of, I'm using grimy in this kind of, black slang context to say like fearless and not on that Motown, middle
Would
class
gritty
aspirational.
be the word?
Gritty.
Gritty
I'm
versus grimy?
gritty. Well, I'm using grimy thinking about the UK context, the Black UK context, just a kind of global description of Black, a kind of Black power in the swag and a kind of fearlessness, right? Grimy, gritty, gangster, but but anyway, let me just say, but I think ultimately, yeah, these, pri no, I, yes, we watch these amazing Black labels. Like Peacock Record and Motown, but we watch Black people suffer under the hands of other Black people, so no liberation, no, a kind of model that I hope can be, redesigned with similar visions, yes, but as is, no, those are not liberatory spaces.
We've been talking with DJ Lanae Denise, author of the book Why Willie Mae, Big Mama Thornton Matters. And I have a million more questions, and we don't have a lot more time. We talked a lot. She has connections at the Bay. Johnny Otis,
Yes.
Alabama, we
Yeah.
talked about her Texas. Mahalia Jackson.
Ooh.
Oh, what's that about? We gotta, that's the, that, Mahalia Jackson is next level, so powerful that the FBI was following her. I know that they were like, whatever. When she comes in the room, Dr. King goes next level, keep tabs on her, right? That's Mahalia Jackson. You know, there is no I have a dream speech unless she's in the audience and is reading the crowd and saying, this fool is boring everybody. Hey, Martin, tell him about the dream. And he shifts gear, right? That was his muse.
Yes.
What was the relationship with, you know, Willie Mae, Mahalia Jackson, the queen of gospel, with this powerful bluesy, you know, songstress, if I could use that word?
Yeah. And
Because
it almost, yeah.
those two worlds didn't always mix. I mean, the gospel world and
Yeah.
the secular world oftentimes were parallel worlds where it's like, don't be backsliding into that world. So I
Yeah.
didn't know that they, you know, what's the story with those?
Yeah. Well, so you did so for your listeners, we're referring to one of the chapters called Saved by the Amazing Grace. And it was a difficult chapter because what I was trying to do was exactly what you read, right? Is make this argument that the line between the blues and gospel is so thin that it is non-existent. In fact, it's non-existent, which is why Thomas Dorsey was someone who was writing with Ma Rainey and for Ma Rainey, and also writing with and for Mahalia Jackson, right? Now, supposedly he left the devil's music behind, right, and became known as the so-called father of the sort of golden age of gospel era in Chicago, right? Where Mahalia Jackson had migrated from New Orleans and found her a church home with Thomas Dorsey, and they began to work together. But the point is that, and I say a little line in the story where someone who knew Mahalia Jackson said that publicly she was a staunch Christian-hearted woman who refused to engage the blues, who felt like the blues and jazz was, yeah, very typical, devil's music, but that she would sometimes listen to Bessie Smith privately, and so that's hilarious to me, like, A, because it makes her human, right? But B, because what is the I because the line between Mahalia Jackson and someone like someone like a Bessie Smith is just very thin, different, and so, yeah, Mahalia Jackson, saved by the amazing grace of Mahalia Jackson, is interesting because it's a layered chapter about the fact that Willie Mae came out with her own gospel album in 1971 called Saved, and then I talk about how in 1971, also Mahalia Jackson dies, and Aretha Franklin is someone who sings at the funeral. It's also interesting to know that Mahalia Jackson sang at Martin Luther King's funeral, by the way, as well. Then it's interesting to know that, as I said, Aretha Franklin sings at Mahalia Jackson's funeral. But before doing that, or after doing that, Aretha Franklin comes out with Amazing Grace, right? Which is her top selling to this day album of all time. It's the
The Queen of
gospel
Soul, the
album,
Queen of
the
Soul.
queen of soul, and the queen of gospel funk. So that was just, so I was just looking at the years between like 1970 and 1972, and so much had happened between those three women, Willie Mae and her first gospel album, Aretha and her gospel album. That is when, essentially Mahalia Jackson dies and passes on the torch. Aretha Franklin sings at her funeral. So it's just like this really interwoven,
But
story.
the thing that stands out in all of that is it all comes from the same seed, right? You know,
Yeah.
I know that from the gospel standpoint, you know, folks were kind of upset when they saw secular music like a Ray Charles or somebody said, man, you're taking gospel
Absolutely.
hymns and you're flipping that, right? But the
Right.
elongation of sound, that whole
Yeah.
feeling, and just the understanding that I'm going to sing with conviction. Right.
Yeah.
I would argue, you know, you tell me because you dug a lot more deeper into this. I think blues artists, the Bessie Smiths and the Willie Mays sung with conviction intuitively. They didn't have to sit in a church and go, that's how we do
Mm-mm.
it. I think this is all coming from the
For
same
sure.
seed, but going
Absolutely.
down different. Okay, we're on the same page on that. You
Yeah.
know,
I love that you said the same seed, but like, sprouting different flowers or something, or different fruit, but it is very much so a same seed vibe, because actually we're talking about a kind of impulse.
An
And
expression,
yeah.
where I think at the end of the day, you lose yourself in it.
Yes, and
Azalea
also, and
Jackson is losing herself when she's
oh,
singing.
she loses us in the pro, and she has us lose ourselves in the process,
But
so
you can
like,
do that with, but listening to, you know, now that I've been listening to Willie Mae Thornton, I'm like, I'm losing myself here. But she
yeah,
ain't no, you can't say she came out of the church. I mean, I guess,
far from it.
no. So what are we saying at the end of the day with all this?
Well, what we're saying is that the blues are a kind of spirituals. The spirituals are a kind of blues. And you don't have one without the other. You
And that's,
cannot
there
have
you
one
go.
without the other.
And hence, that is why you're the author and get paid the big bucks. I like that. Well, maybe not the big bucks, but
Was like, come on now.
no,
I mean,
but
she.
I like that. The blues is a kind of spiritual, and spirituals are the kind of blues. You
Yeah.
know, it's right
Yeah.
there.
Yeah. Yeah.
If we close, anything you want to leave us with, anything you want us to pay super duper close attention to in reading this book?
Yeah. Let's keep it in the bay and bring it to Alice Walker, who is, yes, originally from Georgia, but who made her way to the bay. I bring up Alice Walker because I want to shout out Shug Avery. And I
Yeah.
want to shout out Alice Walker for being among the many Black women who wrote these blues, these wayward blues women into our imagination from their imagination. It is that Shug Avery is a creation of Alice Walker, right? And she is such an embodied spirit in our lives, Shug Avery, that we forget that she is about Alice Walker's imagination. But that's not even how I want to end this. I bring that up because I want us to think about the blues being a kind of spiritual and the spirituals being a kind of blues, because what Alice Walker does in that film when Shug Avery is being drowned out by the close church and the church is being drowned out by the close and nearby juke joint, right? And so the people from the juke joint leave and they go towards the sound, which is the church. And at some point, the choir is singing with Shug Avery, who was on her way to the church with the blues men from the juke joint. And then finally, Shug Avery arrives. The choir is standing. The soloist from the choir is singing. Shug Avery is singing. And the juke joint band is playing. And it is a place in our lives where we get to see the interdependence of the blues and gospel music.
Without sounding corny, can we say that's one nation under a groove? It was
We
sitting
can
right there.
say
It was sitting right there. I had to say that. I mean, it was right there.
it is far from corny. It is perfect to describe that. It is perfect to describe that as one nation under a groove. Far from
Well,
corny.
okay. I was sitting there. I was like, man, don't say that, Dave. It's corny. But you, if you give me permission and you're the
I love
scholar,
it. It's
you know.
perfect.
Okay, because that's the first thing that came to mind.
It's
I
perfect.
appreciate you. Appreciate the book. And you got anything coming out next? There's going to be a movie or anything?
No, I would hope. Hey, I hope somebody reaches out to me about a movie. That'd be amazing. Hey, if anyone's out there, no, I'm just working on this PhD, and then yeah, I'm thinking about my next book, and it will be about Black women musicians. So stay tuned.
Right, because we could have talked about Prince. I forgot you did
Oh,
that. Yeah, there's a whole lot of other things. We might have to have you come back on to go deep into, you
I
know, the
would
purple
love
one.
to.
Yeah.
I
Okay.
would love to.
Yeah. So that's my guy here. You know, I won't show my purple Prince shoes that nobody has. You
Ooh. Oh,
know.
you're one of those, like a real, okay. Yep. Like a
Yeah,
go in.
we do our Prince parties and all that up here. You know.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it. I would love to come back and talk Prince with you. Absolutely.
Okay, there we
Let's think
have it.
about that.
Okay, we're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio, folks. We will be right back.